Hi everyone, welcome to the All Things XR podcast. In today's episode, I have Carl Gutag, a renowned expert in display technologies and augmented and virtual reality. Hi Carl.
Hi there.
Thanks very much for joining me on the All Things XR podcast. Carl, can you tell us a bit about yourself and your journey into the technology world and augmented and virtual reality?
Yeah, well, my career, I really am an electrical engineer by training. I went to Bradley University in Peoria, Illinois, got my BS in electrical engineering, got my master's in electrical engineering out of the University of Michigan. Then I worked for Texas Instruments for 20 years, where I designed integrated circuits. I was involved in almost everything TI had to do in computer graphics and imaging from about 77 through almost 98. So I was there for about 20 years. And worked on all kinds of graphics chips. I worked on the very first Sprite chip, I think called the 9 and 18, using ColecoVision, TI Home Computer, MSX computers in Japan, all over the world. And it was a couple of companies wrote a lot of software for it, Sega and Nintendo. And when they did their versions of it, they actually copied the way, because I actually did the sprite logic and helped design the sprites that were originally done in 19 that were copied later by Nintendo, Sega, and everyone else back in the days when we had sprites. Then went off to led the CPU. A year and a half out of college, I became a CPU architect. I was the lead CPU architect on two 16-bit microprocessors that were follow-ons to the TI's 9900 family. Then I went off and got back into graphics. And in I think 84, we released the 34010, which is the first graphics processor, real full programmable, fully programmable graphics processor. It was kind of a leader in the area, certainly at the higher end, from about through the mid 80s up until about 90. And by that time, other things had overtaken it. But TI, one of the things about TI is that it was very hard to get them to believe, the upper management to believe. I always used to say they give me just about enough money to do okay, but not really succeed. And but we did do several different, a couple of generations of that. And then I went off to do a image processor. So I worked in five CPUs on a chip. So we had four DSP image processors and a RISC microprocessor, all integrated on a chip. And I led the architecture of that. And that kind of led me into the 90s and whatnot. Towards the late 90s, I sort of had there was a little bit of a change in management, and things changed up. And I was invited to get into the field of to become a CTO of a startup. My timing was excellent. I got out right in 98, and the dot-com bust hit. 99. So you couldn't raise capital for anything. Well, anyway, that startup was working on effectively a VR AR headset. It was a monocular. Back then, we didn't have enough brightness, the LEDs weren't efficient enough. So it was LED driving LCOS. And I was involved. How I got from chip architecture to LCOS was in doing the LCOS backplane is basically a computer chip. So we did the IC design and helped architect and did some of the FPGA design for that chip. And that chip is, and the headset itself, though, was using optics, basically using what we call a birdbath today, a little birdbath thing on the end of a boom. Well, we couldn't raise money. That company wasn't going anywhere. So then I got out and I was on my own doing a few things, patent litigation, whatnot. By the way, I think one of the things that's happened with me back in my TI days, I think at TI, I had about 130, 140 US patents. Today, I have about 150.
Yeah.
So I did a lot of work in computer architecture, the sprite chips, all that stuff has all been, you know, there are patents to show what I did. excuse me. About 2004, so there's a little bit of a gap there. 2001, I left the little startup, and then I I, with another partner, formed another company called Syndient. And for 7 years, I was the CTO of Syndient, where we developed much more intelligent backplanes. Because the first backplane was pretty primitive that I did at that first company. And by the time we formed Syndient, I had a much better idea how to control LCOS, liquid crystal, how to do a backplane for that type of technology. So we did a much more advanced backplane at Syndient. So I stayed with Syndient for 7 years. In 2011, I left Syndient and wasn't sure what I wanted to do, but it had been kind of taken over and whatnot. We were focused by this. I would use this lesson to remind people about AR and VR as well. You know, we had everybody and his brother telling us that they're going to put projectors in cell phones. I had every cell phone, major cell phone company, thought they were going to put projectors in cell phones. And that's what we were focused on at Syndient, is because everybody was telling us they wanted it, we started working on projectors and cell phones. Well, every year, the requirements kept ratcheting up, and so it never took off. You may have seen a few cell phone projectors in the market, and there's still today a few little Pico projectors around, but basically, you couldn't meet the requirements, and there was a real fundamental user interface problem, which I've documented on my website many times now. But basically, it was very hard to, you know, where are you going to project from and what are you going to project onto? As I always like to say, an LCD display carries its own black with it. The problem you have with a projector is the projector can only add light. And this is very similar to what we see in AR. We're adding light. We can't take light away very well. And so that some of this all kind of filters in. So I'm not an optics expert. You know, people think because of my blog. So basically, my blog started in 2011. Mm-hmm. And in 2011, I start the blog. Right as I leave Sydney, and I decided to start the blog, really to just kind of keep my hand in and see what was going on. Originally, I planned on writing about the stuff I'd done at TI, my computer graphics stuff and all that. Well, I've never gotten around to that too much. Every now and then I drop a little bit on it. But I got into a little tussle with Microvision. They were doing laser beam scanning. And I'm fairly famous as a guy in the industry who thinks laser beam scanning is crazy. And the reason why is I've studied it back when I was at Syndient. And this was true back in my old days at TI and CPUs and all. I always like to study what other people are doing. I like to know what my competitors are doing. I like to know what competing technologies are doing. So, because that's, you know, you just understand the stuff. Well, I knew a lot about how Microvision worked and how bad it was and how the laser beam scanning was. And it was never going to work. There's some fundamental problems with how you have to move a laser beam that's never going to make a great display device. It's okay for doing LiDAR and stuff. That's a different game. Exactly. But when you're trying to do images that a human's going to see, laser beam scanning is a terrible way to make an image. So anyway, I got into a little tussle with Microvision because they were lying. I knew a lot about lasers going on because I'd worked on. I had a paper that won one of the best papers at a, I think it was an SID conference for we had a paper on LCOS with lasers. And I'd worked with the laser companies and I kind of knew where the state of lasers was. And I thought Microvision was lying to people about the state of lasers. And I said so on my blog. That caused them to file a 10K statement. And my readership went way up in that. And that kind of led me into, it's just, like I say, purely by accident, I got led into it. And then somebody asked the next big thing event was somebody asked, what's this chip inside of the saw a engineering prototype of a Google Glass thing. And I said, oh, that, and I looked at it and I said, well, that's a Hymax chip. I knew Hymax from way back, from actually when I was on my own. Before I formed Syndient, I tried to sell my technology to Hymax. So I knew what Hymax was about. So anyway, I recognized the Hymax chip. Some stock analyst was watching my blog or reading my blog. The next day, their stock went up like over $100 million in market cap. and that's all documented. So anyway, that happened. So that got me into AR. That kind of drifted me. So I just kind of kept following the technology, and it just kind of evolved. So now we're 13 years in now. It'll be 13 years in November that I've been writing on the blog. So it just kind of keeps my hand in, keeps me technically in. And then along the way, I kind of usually get either consulting or business jobs.
I see.
I got a job working on a heads-up display for automotive. I did an aftermarket heads-up display with a startup called NAVDI, where I was CTO. Yeah. And that was around 2013-ish. And I came up with a way. I used DLP in that case. I'm technology agnostic. You know, I think you, when you look at display technologies, I want to use the right technology when it's ready for the market and ready for the application. And in that case, I used DLP for that design. And I could have used LCOS, but DLP was a better choice technically. So that's what we used there. So that got that kind of kept me going and, you know, doing that. And then I've also a more light role. I didn't want to be a CTO again. I'm getting up there. And so I also worked with Raven, who found my blog. And I worked with Raven for about 3 years on their, they were looking at developing an AR headset, a see-through headset for military applications. An excellent gentleman who was a Navy SEAL had formed the company and he wanted guidance on the technical side. And I told him it was going to be a hard slog. I said, you know, if you're out looking for the kind of stuff that a lot of people think, it ain't happening now. And I think he appreciates the fact that I would level with them on what's going on. So anyway, that kind of leads you up to, and then the last, for the last 3 or 4 years, I'm basically just been on my own doing my blog. So
I see.
Occasionally I see. Awesome. Do a little consulting, talk to people who want advice, mostly generic. I'm not, people are surprised, but I don't, what I know about optics, I've all learned on the blog, so to speak. I learned by trying to explain it. One of the best ways to learn something is to explain it to others. Absolutely. And I like to say my blog is aimed at people who are technical, but not necessarily good in optics. If you talk to a guy in optics, they'll go right over your head, over the average person's head. I try to relate it a little more because I'm not trying to explain it to another optics person. I'm really trying to explain it to people who don't know optics.
I see. Great. Awesome.
And by the way, because I've worked in display devices, I never worked, by the way, when I was at Texas Instruments all those years, I never worked on DLP. I knew about DLP. I knew about DLP long before it became public because I became the youngest fellow in the history of the company. I was a fellow at about 10 and a half, 11 years. I became the youngest fellow in the history of the company. So I was involved in a lot of technology and seeing a lot of stuff TI was doing. But I never worked on DLP directly. People in DLP would look at me for processors to go with DLP, but I never directly worked on DLP. But I keep my hand in because of all my background with display devices, having studied competitors and my own, I have a lot of knowledge on display devices. Like, so, and then kind of AR, VR kind of found me. There's just so much. Like the other big one that happened is right after I got out of NAVDI, there was this company I heard called Magic Leap would raise $3 billion.
Yeah.
And, I got kind of famous. I did a whole expose on that because the more I learned about it, the more I felt like it was a scam. It just wasn't going to happen. That what they were promising wasn't possible. And they were using, I don't like when technologists use other words for things. Like they'd call, you know, people call like they had a fiber scanning display. That was never going to work. I knew a lot of, I knew all about the math and stuff from knowing about laser beam scanning. I knew that their wiggling fiber scanning display was never going to work. I knew the math. I knew the principles. I knew what it took to, you know, I could understand what it took to do that stuff. So things kind of, there's always kind of threads that kind of link these together. But anyway, I said Magic Leap, and, you know, they called a wave guy, they called it a photonic crystal. Well, I get really nervous when people start renaming things what there's already a term for. And of course, there was already HoloLens out there. And I didn't particularly, I thought HoloLens was really kind of, you know, and they call their things holograms when they're not. You know, the irony of a Microsoft HoloLens is there's no holograms anywhere. Even the optic can't make waveguides with holograms. Even their waveguides don't use holograms, so there are no holograms. It's kind of like when people go to Disneyland and they see Pepper's Ghost in the Haunted Mansion. That is not a hologram. That is Pepper's Ghost. That's a reflection on glass. Exactly. So anyway, I like people to use the right technical terms when the technical terms are available. Sometimes it's tough in our business because we're kind of inventing the words as new stuff happens. So I do like learning about new stuff. And And I'm also a big photography buff. And so that I like taking pictures and stuff. So I take a lot of pictures inside of headsets and stuff. That's something else I'm known for. And I kind of know the tricks, because it's tricky to take pictures of display devices, because they're, you've got a camera with its own peculiarities and how it scans and reads pixels. And then you have display devices that each have unique ways in which they display pixels. And it can be really tricky, like, to know what shutter speeds and stuff like that to do. So I get into the technical stuff of doing that sometimes. So anyway, that kind of, I think, gets us up to date. If I kind of giving you a long history there, but hopefully that gets you something.
Yeah. Thanks very much, Carl. So Carl, you started this field, I think, earlier than anyone I know, all of the people listening to this podcast. Can you tell us more about how the field looked like back then? And because I've been in this field for about, I think now 12 years, back when I started, AR and VR, especially AR, wasn't very well known, and I had to explain it a lot. So I suppose that back in the time you started, no one knew anything about AR and VR. Can you tell us more about
those days? We started a much more humble attempt, okay? What we were doing is we did a monocular, like I say, it would look very, very similar. I mean, structurally, it looks very similar to what is it RealWare does, where you have like a boom. We were going to have a thing on your head. Now, we're going to have a compute pack, because you literally needed a battery pack and a computer, a little tiny, you know, processor down there with a cable coming up, and then it would be a boom out to the display. And the display was just a, we had an all-cost device. We had a little LED pack, and they weren't very efficient back then. You cannot believe, I mean, the LEDs have gotten massively more efficient. So we could not get enough light. You couldn't think about doing a waveguide. You could barely light up an LED through. Now, you know that if you do a birdbath, it's not particularly efficient because it uses polarized light. So you got to polarize the light, and you got a beam splitter that loses more light. Now, we weren't trying to do see-through, so we didn't have that law. So we had a curved mirror on the front. So it would look a little bit as if you just glossed, like blackened out X-reel. You took an X-reel birdbath. As if it's like you had one of those over your eye. But you can't see through because you don't have enough light coming out of those LEDs to possibly do that. But all we were trying, the original market, and started by a guy named Jerry Rogers, who was founded Cyrex, who was he was a former VP at TI. That's how I happen to know him. And then he after doing Cyrex, he was going to found this. And I thought, hey, man, I got a guy who's made a lot of money in Cyrex. We're going to get funded. Well, we found out he was going to use other people's money. And the other people's money didn't happen. But anyway, the problem is, well, a couple of fold. But one is, the goal of that thing was to basically be, when you're traveling, you could plug it into your laptop. And then when you're on an airplane and stuff like that, that you could just wear this instead, and then you'd have privacy. You wouldn't have this. It was a 1024 by 768 display, so it was higher resolution. It's really at the basically like a good laptop display of its day, because you have to go back to 98. You have to roll things back there. So it was a pretty good laptop display, and you would plug it into your thing, and then you could type on the plane. You'd have privacy and whatnot. It was monocular, so I'm a little bit familiar with some of the monocular versus binocular issues. It looked okay. But anyway, the problem was that the LEDs, I mean, you can only do monocular. It was you're limited in what you could do with it. And I think the bigger issue was, is one of the things I came away with is that people didn't like the use case. As well, you know, you go out there, you don't know. It's really hard to know use cases until you actually go out and try them.
Exactly.
And you just try to say, what's the use model for this? And you try to say, well, are people going to put this on their thing and do it? And it turned out, no, they were going to look at, they were willing to look at their laptop display or whatnot. Privacy is a little concern, but not so much. You know, people use privacy screens, but even a lot of that's gone away these days. There used to be a lot of privacy screens out there. People today, I think, have given up on privacy in some ways compared to where they were back in 98. But anyway, the big problem was is that the dot-com bust hit in 99. People think it happened under George Bush. It actually happened right before George Bush, the market crash. And there was no capital to be had. I mean, nobody wanted to invest in tech for about 3 years there. So really from about 2000, from 99 to about 2002 or three, and even when we were looking to found, there was just no money. By 2000, 2001, the venture capital, it all just kind of dried up, particularly in the, you get outside of California market, but it really dried up. And so it's really hard to raise capital back then. It softened up a little bit by the time we hit 2004 when I was founding Syndient. But a lot of it mm-hmm. comes down to how do you raise capital to do these things. Now, what's interesting though, cost wise, when we found Syndient, we did our first chip from mass design, everything was less than $1 million. Our mass sets were like 200,000. But then when we went to build an ASIC a few years later, because that was going to be a big chip, going to be used in a three chip. Our timing was great there too. We got out just the original Syndient was going to do three chip, three panel L cost for rear projection television. Well, you may remember rear projection television had about a 2 year heyday. About 2 years, it was big, and then it disappeared. So we got there just in time to watch it crash. One thing I learned about the, and this is important in our business and all these other businesses, is that I grew up with the DRAM market. And DRAMs was a crazy market where you couldn't prove that anybody really made money in DRAMs. Semiconductor companies were all doing it. All the semiconductor companies, way back when, there was a dozen, 20 companies doing DRAMs. And nobody was making money. It was they're building these things, building billion-dollar fabs to build a chip that would sell for roughly a dollar or two, and they would make almost no margin on it. It was a crazy business. Well, I thought DRAMs were crazy until I saw the LCD market. The LCD markets will build a $10 or $100 billion fab and sell below cost. So that's the problem. That was a problem we had in rear projection television. They were building 50-inch pieces of glass and shipping them and selling them for prices, and you couldn't figure out how anybody could ship glass and ship it across and do all that for what they were putting a display in there. So anyway, the LCD market is kind of a crazy market in terms of margins. That's why you see almost everybody get out of it. Sony couldn't get it. Sony got out. Everybody got out of it, out of that market, because it was just too. They put their name on something, but they don't actually make the panels anymore because it's just no way to make money on it. So anyway, I've kind of seen the start of it, but yeah, they were basically the market kind of went away. And then after Pico projectors went down, the same technology that we used to build those little Pico projectors, we're building these little chips to go into cell phones. Well, that led that same technology was good for making AR and VR headsets. And that's kind of how I tie into my blog a little bit. Because towards the end of my days at Syndient, we were seeing this uptick in the AR market. So LCOS is I still think, probably the best technology you have today for doing AR. It gets back to the physics of it. You can take an LED that are very efficient now, and you can collimate that light and get a very, very bright light thing that's good for doing waveguides. If you're going to do a waveguide AR today, it's there. Now, TI is making a new bid. One of the things TI is talking about is Texas Instruments is claiming that they're going to kind of re-enter the AR market. They've been in it. They haven't really disappeared, other than I kept seeing designs go away. Company after company was designing out LCOS. TI is now saying they're getting back in, and they've got some interesting technology. So we'll see how that goes. That's layered on top of what's going on with micro-LEDs. Micro-LEDs, Jaybird Display particularly. Jaybird's Display is the only guy really making them. I mean, I consider it making it. When you go to a company, give them cash money, and they hand you a chip, that now you're making. When they have a prototype at a show, well, that's a research and development effort. Yeah, that's an R&D project. You don't know whether that's $1 million. That chip could cost them $1 million to make, and they'd have to charge you $2 million for one chip. You don't know that when you're at a show. It's also hard to tell when a guy's really being successful. Is he going to go into production with it? Well, Jaybird Display at least puts their, you can hand them cash money, and they'll hand you a chip. Now, I still think micro LEDs have a long way to go. They're, it's a tough road to get color on those. You know, Jaybird has done a good job with the X Cube and all to get color, but it's a very expensive and way of doing it. You got to, and tedious, and they're only doing fairly low resolution displays, 640 by 480. So we'll see how that all works out. But basically, that, those are your, you know, in the AR world today, those are your big three. You got LCOS, you have LCOS, DLP looking like they're reentering, and micro LED sounds like, feels like in the long haul it's going to be there. The question is, when is that time? When will it be really competitive? Now, it's competitive if you're doing green only. We're seeing quite a few products coming out with green only. But if you're trying to do color, then that, you got to put three chips together. You got all the optics and alignment and stuff to do that. So that gets kind of expensive. So that's kind of the challenge in the AR side today. And like I say, I start, when it comes to laser beam scanning, like I forgot to mention on that history, I had a big estimate. Probably one of the best set of articles I've ever done on my blog was on HoloLens and how it worked. How the HoloLens 2, uh-huh. The HoloLens 2 with laser beam scanning. And I said, with my experience in laser beam scanning, if somebody comes up with a laser beam scanning display, I start with the premises to scam and work my way backward to figure out why it's a scam. Because it's just, it laser beam, every time I've ever looked at a laser beam scanning display, it always looks better on paper, always talk better than it turns out to ever be. The image quality is always crap. And it gets back to fundamental problem that you can't move the mirrors fast enough. You can't control the laser beam accurately enough. And it just never makes a very good display. So I'm considered biased in that regard, but you know, so far my premise has been proven right. I mean, HoloLens was horrible. It was the worst. I mean, just an unimaginably bad display. They've been so better. They've been miles. They spent a ton of money, probably hundreds of millions of dollars, to build a really crappy looking display. So HoloLens has other advantages. I mean, they did some other stuff that was good, but the display itself was absolutely ridiculous. And it sunk a lot of money, delayed their program, caused all kinds of engineering problems, has problems with waveguides, everything. Anyway, but that's just kind of that. So anyway, that kind of leaves us there. But anyway, that's kind of display technologies I see them today. I think it's going to be a struggle to get micro LEDs all the way over the line. We are seeing product, and I think you know the AR market today is kind of breaking into. I think AR got kind of distracted in a way by wide field of view. I always make this big distinction that VR kind of came first with, you know, Palmer Luckey really made it popular with the work at Oculus Rift and all that. But see, they were taking basically a cell phone. Basically, they figured out that if you take a cell phone display and shove it up really near the eye, you get a big field of view. Okay. Yeah. Cell phone displays have gotten really cheap because there's so many of them being made. So they shoved it up. And then with some cheap optics, you can get a really big field of view. Now, it's hard to get high resolution. That's one of the problems we see in VR. VR never has quite the resolution. Well, what happened is that kind of spoiled people for field of view. Now, that's the only number they seem to understand is field of view. Well, in AR, getting field of view is next to impossible. Really big field of views. Because what happens is you can't put, like what did he do? Palmer Luckey and those guys, they put the display right in front of your eyes. Well, you don't have any, really, and this is a big misnomer, conceptual misnomer, is that people think that optics are magnifying. They do magnify a little bit. But most of what magnification is defined as at 25 centimeters. Well, if you make something closer to your eye than 25 centimeters, it's getting bigger. That's magnifying it. Most of what the optics is doing is letting you focus. So the main job of optics in a VR headset is to actually let you focus. A little bit of magnification. I think it's like, depending upon the exact optics, but I did an experiment once, and it said about 75% of the magnification comes by moving the display closer. 25% is the optics making the pixels look bigger. So most of your magnification is actually coming out of moving it closer to your eye. Well, the problem we have is, we do AR, we can't block. We don't want to put the display here because that'll block your vision. So we put the display back someplace else, And now we have to come up with really complicated optics to route that around, get it to the eye, and combine it with the real world. It's a really hard problem. Plus, we need typically an extremely bright display. Like, typical VR headset is less than 100 nits going to your eye. If I put 100 nits here, well, the rest of my room, even a fairly mediocre room, is going to have a lot of 100 nit light sources. My display, my computer monitors, all the other stuff in the room. If I go outside, concrete's going to be 7 to 10,000 nits. So I'm looking down at a white sidewalk on the sunny day. It's 10,000 nits. 100 nits, you're not going to see nothing. You won't even know it's there. So we have to be a lot brighter. Plus, I mean, so really, AR has all these hard problems because they can't put the display, because optically you'd like to put it straight in front of your eyeball. Can't do that. So we've got to put it around someplace. We've got to come with optics. We have to be very, very bright. And supporting field of view gets really complicated because our optics are around right here and we've got to get this. And what happens is, if you want to try to support a wide field of view with see-through optics, the thing gets huge. Now you're onto a helmet. You're not glasses anymore. So the market is kind of bifurcating. I think what we're going to see is kind of the all singing, all dancing type glasses, and the and then these, for lack of a better word, these so-called AI glasses. But basically, we're going to see people put, and we're seeing a lot of this happening right now. I mean, there's a few, I've written about a few of them lately. A lot of them using Jaybird for the green ones. People will also be doing it with LCOS and maybe with DLP as well, where you say, I'm only going to go for like 30 degree field of view. Sounds, if you're in the you know, VR world, it sounds really crazy. But if you're in the AR world, that's pretty much what you need. Really, the sweet spot of human vision, what you see with on a day, most of what you have with any visual acuity is within 30 degrees. People talk about the fovea. The fovea is like, I think, only about 6 degrees. But the way it works is the eye wobbles around. And the way your vision works is your eye kind of wobbles around and directs that and builds up an image that your brain and your visual cortex and all that processes into what you think is a full image, when really you're not seeing hardly anything at any given instant in time. But it builds up a high-resolution image to your mind from scanning around this little, the fovea. So really, the eye doesn't like to go out about 30 degrees. 30 degrees is really the outer limit of this, of what the eye, where the eye wants to sit. So if you have 30-degree field of view, that's actually good for most purposes. It's not immersion. See, people are getting confused. If you want to do VR, VR is about immersion. You want to be totally immersed. AR is more about getting something done. This is, by the way, the big mistake. I think, you know, I spent a lot of time this year looking at Apple Vision Pro and the Meta Quest Pro and stuff. Pass-through AR and optical AR are almost totally different things. If you looked at what you want to do with each one, there's hardly any overlap. People, you're not going to be able to do with a headset, with a pass-through AR, pass-through stuff with cameras. You never can simulate, you never come close to the human vision. There's the dynamic range of the human vision, the way the world is focused in depth, the way it behaves. It's actually dangerous. You know, if you look at all these applications, they all basically tell you, don't wear this outside, don't walk around with this, don't. That's because they're going to get sued. If people start walking around outside with like Apple Vision Pros, they're going to get killed. You know? Can be dangerous even with optical AR, but it's suicide. It's literally, it's like you're just playing Russian roulette to go outside and wearing a headset like that. Because you could get hit by a car. You just won't see. You're not going to see things that are going to get you hurt really bad. You don't realize, we always joke, and this has been a joke since the 80s. I remember I learned this. We always say peripheral vision was there to keep you from getting eaten by the tiger. And the idea is that peripheral vision has no, your outer vision has no acuity, no ability to read anything, no ability to do anything. Its sole purpose is to warn you to turn your head. Because something's about to hit you or eat you. Okay. Yeah. So it's the peripheral vision is there to warn you, not to give you any kind of acuity. So what people don't appreciate that, and when you're doing the VR type stuff where they just talk about needing just uber wide field of view. So anyway, the market in AR is right now, we're going to see a lot of entrants going after these 30-ish degree field of view, 25 to 30 degree field of view. Some will be color, some won't. And this is going to be a big push in the next year to see if we can break, if that can break through. I'm actually somewhat agnostic on it. I see the good and the bad of it. Will consumers like it? But we are seeing people, that are getting down they're getting down to a very much a glasses form factor. I mean, they're talking weights down in, Vuzix and even Realities. I just wrote about them. Those two guys, and they're below 40 grams. That's getting good. These the glasses I wear are 28 grams. So 40 grams is okay. When guys say 80 grams, those are getting a little tubby. You're going to see they're going to need big nose pads and stuff like that. That's getting a little too heavy. And they're going to look less like glasses and more like kind of slim down. Okay, I've talked a lot. Hopefully it's taking you some point.
That's great, Carl. So, Carl, when do you think that we'll have a fully functional AR display with a good field of view?
What was the last part?
I'm asking, when do you think that we will have a fully functional augmented reality display with a good field of view, considering the current state of displays and the speed of technology these days?
The problem is, it's really more of physics. It's really hard to get beyond about 30 degree field of view.
Mm-hmm.
What happens is, you get into what I call the death spiral, or I joke that AR glasses always start with Ray-Bans and end up with HoloLens.
Uh-huh.
And the problem is, okay, and I just walk them, it's a real simple thought exercise. I say, okay, 30 degree field of view, we know what that is. That's going to be about 40 grams. You know, we can do that, 40 grams, whatnot. We can do it with waveguides. We got to put some optics in there. You know, in reality, one thing I'll give them, they've really focused on more integrating it. Other companies are trying to do snap-in and stuff. But they're trying to work. They got to work on the prescription issue, too. More and more people are needing prescription glasses. But anyway, here's the problem. As soon as you go beyond about 30 degrees, you spiral into HoloLens. And then what happens is you say, what else do you, first of all, you now need bigger projectors, more power, more batteries. You go 50 degrees, you've more than doubled everything. You're about 2.5-3 times as much stuff you need. So you have more processing power, more batteries. How are you going to get the bandwidth? The other big trick is, I really think if you're going to be all day wearable, can't have wires on it. It's got to be wireless. So you got your processor in the computer. Really, the smartphone's going to be your processor. But now, if you start doing higher resolution, start doing more stuff, now where's your bandwidth coming from? That's not, like, even Realities doesn't even do any kind of video or images or anything, really. It's just doing really simple drawings type stuff. It's not there to do anything photographic or video or whatnot. Because the bandwidth will kill you. If you have a lot of video bandwidth and you're going to do it wirelessly, that's a lot of power. So what happens is, as soon as you start saying, oh, I want 50, 60-degree field of view, well, you start spiraling. You start saying, well, okay, I'm gonna double my battery, triple my battery, quadruple my battery. I'm going to go with a bigger display, which is more LEDs. I got more bandwidth I need, so I need more of all that. Oh, do you want SLAM? You want to recognize your hands? Well, where am I going to put the cameras? So I start putting cameras around here.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah.
And you see what's happening. Oh, you want to get rid of the phone now? You want me to put the processor up there? Okay, we'll put the processor and the battery up there. Okay.
Gets larger. So now
you got HoloLens. That's what happens to you. I think we're a long way from being able to get much beyond. I think 30 degree field of view. I think will be a challenge to get 30 degree field of view full color and then with enough bandwidth to communicate down to the phone that it can be wireless. Because I think if it's not wireless, then it's not all day wearable right off the bat. And that's one of the criteria. And I think the problem is once you get beyond 30 degree field of view, you've gone beyond 40 grams, you're probably into 80 grams plus, 80 to 100 grams, and on your way to the moon. Because you start saying, what else goes with... See, the thing is, you got to come up with a feature set. And this is something I said about Even Reality. One thing I appreciate about them, they had a fairly consistent feature set. You know, this makes... You know, they had a philosophy, and they kept that philosophy throughout their design. What happens with people is they start... Once you start straying and start saying, well, I'm building glasses... You know, to me, as soon as you say 50-degree field of view, forget glasses. You're not in glasses. You've already blown glass. You can't do it in basic health. We're a long way from being able to do 50-degree field of view, full color, with glasses. And then if you want to add SLAM or whatnot, I don't know if we ever get there, because where are you going to put the cameras and stuff? You're going to start, you're getting away from this. But there is something to be said for, if you look at the Even Reality approach, and also Vuzix doing it with their V100, and they have a sports series and stuff like that. Very similar kind of concept, a little different shape, but basically the same thing. It's a Jaybird display micro LED going in the eye. Even then, you know, you look at Even Reality, they have very little display. They're only using like a third. That was one of my surprises. They're only using about a third of the total display. So they're not even doing 640 by 480. They're doing 640 by maybe 180 pixels. So they're only doing a small strip, because here's another big problem. The most important feature in a set of all-day wearable AR glasses is how you see through them when the display is off.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you can't wear them, if you won't wear them when the display is off, then you won't wear them. Mm-hmm. Okay? That's just there. Yeah. And so what Even Reality did, consistent, they made a compromise. They said, we're not going to make the display so big. You know, they cut everything. Now that cuts power by making the display smaller. They have less power, less bandwidth and whatnot. So there's some consistency there with being, so that's the road they take. Now in the case of Vuzix, Vuzix is monocular. So Vuzix is monocular, and maybe a little off the side, but I think it actually, you look through it. But they went monocular. So you now got one eye clear, one eye not. And they got a bigger display. So actually, there are actually more pixels on a Vuzix, the Vuzix Ultralight V100, whatever, than there is in the reality. That's the thing I get into on my blog, by the way, is I'm oftentimes reverse thought process, not really reverse engineering, but I'm trying to think, what was this guy thinking when he built this product? And one of my favorite phrases is, when smart people do something dumb, it's because the alternative was worse. Meaning that they were trying to avoid some other problem when they created this problem. And you can see that in the design, that you can't do everything. And I think these studies or looking at these things is an interesting way to figure out, well, why hasn't it happened and when will it happen? Is to start looking at, well, what are people running around? Well, Even Realities was running around messing up with your forward vision. They were fighting power and stuff. Same with Vuzix, doing it in a different way. And so you just kind of see people taking different stabs at it. But AR is really hard, and it's extremely hard to make something when you turn it off that doesn't have any problems. Almost everything that will combine light from a display someplace, and I don't care if it's a waveguide or whatnot, they have different amounts, but everybody's got to damage. I call it damaging the real world a little bit. That you do damage to both. You basically, anything that's going to combine light is going to do damage to both of them a little bit. And the question is, how do you make that balance? You know, if I put a diffraction grating up here, well, you capture light, you get maybe a little blurriness because you're going through a grating. And even though it's not tuned, you know, it's tuned to a wavelength, it still has effects. It still acts like a grating on other light. So it causes a little bit of blurriness and whatnot. So you put a grating in front of the eye, you might affect the vision a little bit. And that gets to be a hard problem if you're trying for, once again, this all-day wearable thing. Then we have there's a whole other category of what I'll call business or enterprise stuff. And that's where there's a real market for that. That one's an easy elevator speech. HoloLens had it. The problem is they had a lousy product. But the basic concept is, if I can help a business, like a guy working on a car, working on a factory line, working at on UPS, working at on a, you know, an Amazon warehouse, picking stuff and whatnot, I can put a headset on you. There's a lot of application for put a headset on you, and I can turn you into get increase your expertise, increase your abilities, and I don't have to do it by very much because people are expensive, yeah. You know, particularly in America. You know, if you have a fully lated person, you know, you can be talking $100,000 a year in a lot of situations or more. Engineers way up there, but you know, just a factory worker. By the time you figure the cost of equipment, the cost of facilities, healthcare, benefits, vacation, dot dot dot, a person is pretty expensive to put in a shop. Well, business, it's real easy to convince them. Say, look, I make that guy 10% more expensive, pays for itself in a couple of months. And that's basically the argument for AR, is that it can. And now, this is what I call another one of my little sayings now is I call, are you paid to use it? Are you paying to use it? Okay. Paying to use it is a consumer. Consumer pays to use something. In an enterprise environment, you're paid to use it. Mm-hmm. And so when you're paid to use it, your acceptance is different because you're going to wear this to do your job. If it makes you more effective. I mean, the classic example, you know, all the news these days is Boeing, but you can imagine you have workers in a line and you could have AI and all kinds of things working there. By the way, that's one thing I thought even reality missed out on. And also I think Vuzix doesn't have cameras on their low end. Their higher end, bigger stuff has cameras, but cameras are one of these other touchy issues. But without cameras, you have a real hard time, I think, in the AI feedback loop, because a lot of what I was working on when I left TI, this ties way back to everything we talked about earlier, but I was working on a thing called, it was originally the MVP or the 320C80, which was originally called the image system processor, because I felt like the next thing after graphics processors were going to be image processors. That's kind of getting to be in vogue these days. Maybe I was a little too far ahead on that one. But you know, image recognition is really a thing that is less bounded. Displays, with a display, I'm limited by human vision. I have to make an image that your human eye can see. With recognition, I'm bound by compute power, you know, and camera resolution and whatnot. It's a little less bound because I can go away, compute it, whatnot, and then later off generate something the eye can see. The problem we have in generating display devices is we have to make something that a human can, you're really kind of tricking until we can get to that optic nerve or get straight into your brain somehow. Right now, we're limited by the eyes. We're trying to make something that we can make the eye take in. Whereas it's a little different with recognition. Recognition, it can do all kinds of nasty stuff. It's like I said with LiDAR. Laser scanning, never going to work with human vision. It's just a sucky way to do displays. But if you're trying to like scan a room and figure out stuff for distance or whatnot, it's a pretty good way to do it. The difference is it can scan around and the image it puts up, if you look at the image that comes from that process, no human's going to want to look at it. It looks like crap, okay? But it doesn't need to look good. It's getting different information, has different characteristics than what it can do it. And then same with cameras. Cameras can also do some of that, but they don't have depth. So what you want to do is kind of start mixing this up. But if we start putting all this stuff on front of you, I'll kind of put a camera or two up here, put a LiDAR sensor up here, start doing all that stuff. Well, now I'm into HoloLens. I got a helmet. Or got, I call it open helmet. But you kind of end up doing like this. See, it's coming like Magic Leap ended up in Nowheresville. They ended up, they were trying to avoid, they were kind of, they once again, if you look back at their old patterns, which I've got all on my blog and stuff, you know, they were going to do glasses. They ended up with the thing that's basically a helmet that kind of, you know, it's kind of a tweener helmet. But it's basically a helmet with the big bands and big heavy stuff and all. And it ends up as heavy as a helmet. And they didn't fool anybody. By the way, these are kind of design things, you know. I mean, everybody's done the game of, well, we put the battery and the processor off on a cable. That's what I did at Silicon Display. That was a company I worked at 98, 99, into 2000. That company, that's what we did. We had to put in a battery pack. We had a battery and a computer, all the processing, cable coming up. Then, you know, Microvision, or not Microvision, Magic Leap does the same thing. You know, oh, how genius. They put the compute pack and the battery down there. And then Apple comes around and they say, well, we're going to put the computer up here and the battery down there. I think that's the stupidest of all. I'm not a fan of that thing is. You know, by the way, the very first Magic Leap I had, and I wrote about it, and I knew it was going to be a problem. Very first Magic Leap I had, I was doing my demos and all, and I got tired because it hurts my eyes and whatnot. So I set it down on a table, had the thing in my pocket, because the very first ones, I got one of the very first ones. They didn't give you a holster with it. And I had the compute pack in my pocket, turned around, thing went whipping off the table and broke the headset.
Oh,
and by the way, somebody's done. I know I saw online somebody did that to an Apple Vision Pro. That's one of the big problems with having that cable. There's no cable that will break away enough to keep you safe. That won't stay. That won't be break away too easily to not be annoying. Turns out, you know, people. Mm-hmm. Apple's, I think, they got people really hooked on magnets. Magnets actually are not a very good connecting technology because it what happens is the forces get stronger and stronger as it gets closer. So it's like once it breaks really bad. But it if you really want it to stay together, you need a ton of force, and then it's really hard to break apart. Mm-hmm. One of my favorite connectors, I kind of like USB-Cs because I like the way that it's a nice mix between staying in. And its ability to pull out without, you know, you won't get that with a magnet. Magnets are, what happens is as soon as it gets close, you know, it kind of snaps. And then it's very hard to get off, or the magnets have to be so weak that it's all the time getting knocked off. Now, if it's on your laptop and your laptop has a battery, yeah, no big deal. The thing just does out. But you notice Apple, I was shocked that Apple, they wired it in on one end, and then they got this thing with the little pin that you can take it off the other if you really had to. But it's really a bad. It shouldn't be wired in. I want to take that to a safety lawyer and see what he thinks of putting that out on a factory floor because you know that thing's going to get yanked and yank the guy's head. If that cord gets grabbed, it's going to yank the guy's head around. Mm-hmm. And something's going to get either the headset or the person's going to get destroyed if that thing gets grabbed by something.
I see. Yeah, totally. And Carl, what do you think? How do you think actually AI and especially generative AI can help with AR and VR? Because AI in many cases can fill the gaps for the hardware. And it's like, you know, the argument with Tesla, having the Tesla argument with LiDARs and RGB cameras, as I'm sure you know about that. How do you think AI can fill the gaps and help the hardware to help the industry reach a better products?
Well, I think the biggest thing is I'm really big on the recognition side of stuff. I say, I think even realities, they had a good philosophy, but you know, but it's tough because, man, now as soon as I say cameras, now I'm off on my I'm on my way to HoloLens, right? Because but I really if it really feels like those kind of glasses need a camera if you're going to, because to me that's the more interesting AI, like the whole audio AI. Where you're talking, you can't be talking and explaining. You can't be describing your world to the head. You can't be talking all the time, trying to explain things and having AI figure out what it is. Mm-hmm. I think, you know, there's this translation app. That's one of the problems you get into, too, is you start seeing the same application over and over again, but you don't see people doing much with it and say, have they really, you know, does it sound good in theory and not too much in practice? My favorite one is the aliens on the wall. If you look at pass-through AR, you look at optical AR, you look at the video game. If you look at it, it's almost the same video game for everybody. They put things on walls. Like if you're doing any kind of AR game, they put things on walls and then you shoot at them because shootings are really, if you go to theme parks, anybody tries to do a human interactive thing, it's almost a shooting analogy because the only thing that you can understand in 5 minutes and get going. The problem I have seen is beyond having aliens or things coming out of your walls, which seems kind of neat when it first happens, is it really a good play technique? Does it work? Because the problem you have with AR, and this is, you know, I'll get back to the main subject of AR, but it gets back to this translation thing, is that when you do translation, you say, well, okay, like I'm going to be going to Germany at some point this year. And, you know, I don't speak German at all. But, you know, I was there before. You take your phone, you hold it up to signs. One of the most important things is to be able to read signs, right? Like if I walked up to a sign, I wouldn't know how to read it. So if I want to see a sign, I can hang my cell phone. The problem is that happens to me once every few years. You know, I imagine if somebody travels all the time might be a little more often. If you're going to China all the time, if you're a Silicon Valley guy and you're going to China a lot, well, maybe you need that on-the-fly translation. You understand the app better. But, you know, I'm not going to buy my glasses. I'm not going to buy a pair of glasses just to do translation. It's not enough. Mm-hmm. That doesn't get it over the hump for me. Now, it might be if you're, you know, if I'm going to an international business meeting, I could sneakily, you know, get AR glasses in there and they don't think I speak the language. Well, yeah, I could see that for a stealth thing, but that's a really tiny audience. Mm-hmm. But that's kind of the problem we have with a lot of these apps is, you know, really saying what's the use case for these things. I understand the use case for adding intelligence to a person on a factory floor. Cameras become important. But I think that's the big thing for where I think AI fits in that I see, or at least I feel like I see, is where the AI is being used to use cameras all the time to tell you stuff so it can help you. Like you may say, what is that? Or read that sign for me. You know, that kind of thing is where I would see it. So cameras, to me, become very integral to the whole process. And I think the camera, that the glasses. Now, if I'm doing translation, let's take the translation example. Let's say I say, read that sign to me, right? It'd be better if it would just show me. First of all, it's hard when you hear the words come in. You may not totally understand, and it's hard to roll back audio. Now, yes, if you can tell your thing, again, repeat, it'd be much better if it just put it up in my eye for me. So, like, if I was going to, even if you're doing audio translation, somebody's talking, and it's going to translate on the fly, you can easily see how having a display up there would make it a much better thing, because sometimes you can read stuff, but you can't even understand when you hear it. The combination of being able to see it and hear it. And the beauty of seeing it is it can stick up there for a while because air, you know, audio comes and goes. It lasts. It's the instant those sound waves go by you, it's gone. Whereas the video, you've got it there. So I think they're cooperative, they're synergistic, and that they help each other out. You actually, if you were doing translation, it would be better with both that. Mm-hmm. But I do think that the biggest thing that AI gets into, so the AI will be used for some audio. So I look at AI as basically a way of improving the input side. I look at something, I look at your face, and it tells me, oh yeah, your name and whatnot. You know, let's say, because, you know, I'm in a crowd. I know one of my problems is I was a TI fellow in 11 years. There were thousands of people at TI who knew me and who I may have only met once.
Yeah.
So I'm not particularly good with names and faces. So that's not my forte. I can remember circuit diagrams and electronics and circuitry and stuff, but I'm no good with names and faces.
I've met people.
Probably an engineer trait.
Exactly.
But you can imagine where it could augment you that way. But I think audio is basic. I look at AR right now as its big advantage is in the input side. I can't see how it's going to help the display too much other than how it causes you to do it. Now, maybe there's some way to enhance images and stuff. I don't know. But I look at it mostly as an audio and video input. But it's going to make that once you have that, now you have the ability to take things in and see them, or take things in and hear them, and so I look at it mostly as a augmenting, as really being the input side, and we're kind of seeing that with Google the Meta Ray-Ban glasses seem to be of course you always have a problem when they say it was bigger than we thought. Compared to what? You know, what were you thinking? Were you thinking small, or is it you know, people are using them, but mostly techno geeks, not the, I don't see them in the broad market. You know, it's not like phones. You know, the problem is, the problem we have is, it goes by, you know, it's like, it. You know, they talk about, what is it, they, what is it, a camel is a horse made by committee? You know, and that's a little bit what we've got in AR. You got people doing VR things and expecting it to have wide field of view. If it doesn't have 120 degree field of view, I don't have anything. Well, if you have 120 degree field of view, your glasses are going to be this big. Sorry, you got to have a way to wrap it around your face and whatnot. That's just physics. But the problem is how do you compete with a cell phone? You know, how do you get to those billions and billions of units? You know, that's the problem that they have is, you know, if we're talking like millions of units, like if we looked at the industrial environment, you know, that's hundreds of, that can be millions of units, maybe a few millions of units. It's not hundreds of millions. It's measured in probably the single digit millions. It's about as big as you can get that market to be. And that's being optimistic. And that's assuming a pretty good yearly turnover rate and whatnot. Because we got to remember, you're going to put those things out there, then you got to obsolete them. You know, they're going to be out there for a while. So, yeah. Whereas if you look at the consumer market, then you say, well, how many people are really going to need smart AR glasses and want that? I think we'll see at the high end. Like, you know, it's like Apple. You know, people talk about the Apple price. That's one of my other big pet peeves. You know, I said from day one when I saw that thing, I said, hey, this thing is price-wise is cheap for something new in technology. Functionally, it's crap. The problem with the Apple Vision Pro is the functionality sucks. It's not what people need or want. If I go, you know, I always make this thing. I say, I think that the first Apple II, the original Apple II that started Apple, and really had a big effect on the whole PC market, I think it would be adjusted for inflation like $6,000.
Yeah.
The Mac One, adjusted for inflation, I think around $6,000 to $7,000. People are a little spoiled by what technology costs. There were plenty of people, as showed in the initial sales, there are plenty of people who, if that changed their life, if that had a life impacting, my life is better now because I bought this, they could have sold tens of millions of them at that price, if it was life impact changing, but it's not. I've got one. I can pull it out of the box. I put it on every now and then to remind myself. It's not life changing. Okay, So it's a different game. And then the question then becomes: for AR glasses, will they be life changing? If you want to get to hundreds of millions of units, you kind of got to put it on and say, my life is better or feels better with this. Whether it is or not, you know, going to all the controversy today of social media and whatnot with all the kids on phones, you know, the whole big hoo-ha-ha and that, whether is it really making life bigger or only making you think you have a life bigger. But if you're going to sell a lot of them, you at least got to make somebody think their life is going to be better because they're wearing it. You know, things are better. So that's going to be a big problem. I think it's a big hill to climb to get from the millions of real, there are millions of real units to be had. The trick is, how do you get past the millions and into consumer product? And that goes back to my, are you paid to wear? Or are you paying to wear? And that's a harder problem. You know, we'll probably see it. Like I say, we're going to see it played out this next year or so, because there are a lot of people working on it, including the big names, are going to come up with these low field of view, fairly lightweight, you know, whether they have cameras or not. I think, you know, the cameras is the biggest problem in some ways, because you think about it, where am I going to put a camera on my glasses? I mean, I've got to have a bigger frame.
Yeah.
And I got to have more power to power the camera. And then if the camera is going to be processed, I got to have more battery power to get it, to send all that stuff down to the phone. And that all ends up being power. They get hot. You know, you saw what the guys, I don't believe like I said, the scam, humane AI. I mean, as soon as it said laser scanner, I said scan, and it was, you know, but the thing on hand, but even the rabbit proved, you know, it's
rabbit is humane.
It didn't have the display problem, but it was all the same problem. I think glasses are more natural fit. You know, they're just on, you have it there, more incognito-y, but still you got to figure out where you can put cameras and stuff.
Exactly. So, Carl, what do you think about AI helping computer vision? What I have in mind is, you know, previously for having a good scanning capability or having a good depth estimation scenario, you got to have, for example, a LiDAR sensor, etc. But computer vision plus RGB camera currently with AI can do such scenarios and help on the hardware side. What do you think about this trend, and how do you think it will impact the display technology, the products in this category?
Yeah, I mean, the trick is a lot of the visualization, I don't know if I totally follow you there, but a lot of things that you can conceive of doing end up being fairly narrow markets. You know, in other words, yeah, it's like 3D reality. Like if I was to do these things like a 3D design studio, right?
Uh-huh.
You know, you see a thing with headsets that do all this stuff, all this immersion, all this 3D stuff. You know, I can make you think like Vario is famous for doing this. Okay. You know, they make you think you're right there. You look at it, you think, you know, you've done the merge with the real world, and you can see a car. Okay. Well, that's great, but you're not going to sell many of those. I mean, it's good for that guy. You can pretend you're walking on the moon. That's great if you're going to be walking on the moon. You could see it for pilot. You know, you see airplane pilot training and stuff like that. There's a lot of things you can do that would make things more real and whatnot. But the question is what kind of market there is. And I think if we're going to look at anything kind of big, that's a long ways off from doing that, because the level of stuff you have to have, the level of compute and everything you have to have up here is huge. So now we're into the more industrial app side of things. If I'm understanding you correctly, to get that level of kind of, you're going to have all the LiDAR sensors and cameras and everything. And then you have to say, who is this person that's going to be doing that? So I don't know if I totally answer your question, but that I just think, we're a long ways off from having AI you can, you know, wear in a pair of glasses and maybe even, you know, in a helmet that's really going to change the world that much. I mean, there'll be niches. like one of the best applications, humanitarian-wise anyway, is medical. You can definitely see where stuff like this is going to get used in the medical field.
Yeah.
To help you visualize stuff, help you see stuff, give you X-ray vision, or give you the ability to see an MRI, you know, basically overlay an MRI with a person's arm or hand or whatever. All that kind of stuff's going to happen. But how many people operate on people? How many people are physicians? You know, it's a small market. So it's not that it's unnecessary. It's not that the technology, there isn't all these spinoffs and other things that'll happen. But the problem is how do you get this to an everyday need basis, or getting people to really want it? You know, things like the translation, even, you know, you look at translation and you say, well, that's a good use of AI, and it makes sense, and yeah, I'd kind of like that, but I'm not going to do that every day. You know, yeah, there'll be somebody's going to move over to Germany or Japan or China or someplace, and they'd probably pay a lot of money for that. If you could give them good translation and whatnot, there's somebody going to do that. But that's not like 80-90% of the population. That's probably a few percent.
Yeah, to get your point. So, Carl, with the challenges of AR you mentioned, do you think Apple Vision Pro and Facebook and Meta with Meta Ray-Ban, do you think they've chosen a good approach product-wise?
Well, I think Apple, all the indications are that Apple wasn't really trying to get into VR. They just kind of, they accidentally got there. you know, they were really wanting to do AR. I think, and here's the problem we have is I think most people think that the VR market is of a known quantity and size. They basically look at VR as a subset of the game market. Basically, you have the game market, but then within the game market, not everybody who do games will even mess with AR. AR gets headaches, it's motion, and it's got a lot of other, there's a lot of negative uses. The people who like it really like it. So it's a little bit like audiophiles, you know. The people who like it, like Big Screen Beyond, I mean, they're quite successful from everything I can understand. They're actually making money. They know their audience. Their audience is that dedicated gamer guy. their headset's not made for everybody. You know, everybody and his brother. They're made for people who are serious gamers. So you got this aficionado market. The problem is how do you expand that out beyond just a few people? So let me think. I think I lost my train of thought there where I was going with that. What was the question again?
I asked you product wise if you think Apple Vision Pro with pass through and Meta Ray-Ban with going with AI and just capturing the screen is a good approach considering the AR challenges right now.
Yeah, I think it was something they could do. I think it's proven to be pretty bad. I mean, they're not doing the Pro 2. There's talk they're doing, you know, they're going to do a low cost one. I don't think the problem. I'm adamant on this. I don't think the problem with the Apple Vision Pro was the price. The problem was the functionality. I don't know how you're going to reduce the functionality. How you're going to reduce the price, which will mean reducing the functionality, and how that's going to make it. Now, the thing they can get rid of is the wink and blink and eyes. You know, I call them the wink and blink and eyes. They can get rid of that. That was stupid. Six ways to Sunday. That showed me that they had more money than brains when they were doing that product. That they, you know, they had too much money. They'd been better off to have people who were more startup oriented. And since that was, I don't know who put that on there, but that was stupid because it's bad for heat. It showed me that they weren't appreciating how hard a problem they were trying to solve. It's like, we have time for fall wall and fillity. We're doing all this other fun stuff. We have so much that, but they didn't realize how hard a problem they were solving. But if you take that off, that saves a little bit. It saves power, saves heat, you know, makes things better. But what are you going to do? You're going to make the displays lower resolution. That's the most expensive component of the whole thing is the display. So you're going to go negative on the display. And then what are you going to do about cameras and stuff? And you know, and then even if it's called, I have one for free. I already paid for it. So it's free now, right? Once you pay for something, it's free, right? It's not like, why do I want to put this on?
Yeah.
I'd much rather watch a movie on a computer monitor. By the way, most people do. You get the jollies. It's like there's a lot of the commonality between 3D, and it is a good, better than some ways for watching 3D movies than any theater would be. But the problem is people just aren't, there's not that much need for watching 3D movies. We tried that. They keep saying, oh, it was the glasses. It was polarization. It's always an excuse. But in the end, people say, yeah, that was a great novelty. It's a trick to go from what I call a theme park, something that works in a theme park, to something that works in your home every day. Or something that works in a movie theater that will work in your home every day. It's a different thing. Now, I think that they're struggling to, the problem that they're faced with, and this is the thing I was going back when I lost my train of thought, was that when you go from the VR market is this subset of the game market, right? Well, AR, we don't know what the market is. So what you do is you say, they think they know the size of the VR market and it's not big enough because they're looking at their phone market and saying, that's nowhere near as big as the phone market. So if it's not as big as the phone market, we're not interested in it. So then you look over at AR and you say, well, we don't know what the market is, but at least we don't know how big it is. So we'll take the uncertainty. We will take the uncertainty of whether there is a market versus something that we think we know what the market size is. Mm-hmm. And so that's kind of where AR is more interesting. I think the thing we'll see this year or in the next year is going to be Meta. And I don't have any inside information on this, but everyone's expecting that Meta is going to do something putting a display into the glasses. And so that'll probably be the next move, the next big move. I think Apple's struggling because I always said that Zuckerberg was a true believer. You could tell. If you listen to Zuckerberg, you'd see he knew some of the techno lingo. He used it appropriately. He understood what he was saying. Whereas I always said Tim Cook was hostage to it. He looked like a guy who was reading the teleprompter. You know, he was given a speech. He believed in it because he was told he believed in it. You know, he didn't have any, there was no depth to anything Tim Cook ever said. Whereas if you listen to to Zuckerberg. Zuckerberg, you can tell he has some level of knowledge. I don't know if he appreciates how hard it is, but he's not just a believer. He's an evangelist within his own company. Whereas Tim Cook is a guy being told, this is the next big thing, you believe in it. And I think that's going to waver. I thought Apple would not release it. I thought Apple would have the best thing, I was expecting Tim Cook to come out and say, we had the best thing going. It just blew away everybody else, but it just wasn't Apple enough. And I think they released a product that wasn't Apple enough. And I think they kind of showed that they can only do, you know, they found the bound of what they could make people accept. And I have a lot of Apple product, you know, the Apple Vision Pro, you can't use it in a sentence. I think it wears out on movies. I've been on planes. I haven't seen many. I've never seen one in the wild. What I call it in the wild. You just see somebody on an airplane wearing it. I know there are reports of people doing it, but I haven't seen one. Whereas I said, you can tell what a success looks like because many years ago, when the day the iPad came out, within a week I was on an airplane and I saw three or four of them on an airplane. Mm-hmm. And I call that the airplane test. And what that means is you can tell when something is caught on because people who fly on airplanes are typically somewhat gadget conscious. They'll pay premiums for anything that deals with boredom. And you know, we buy the expensive earphones, noise canceling headsets. They have the gadget. They're very gadget thing. Anything that would fit in a briefcase that's neat and will pass the time, they'll buy. Okay, mm-hmm. And they have the disposable income to do it, and they'll pay, you know, more than the average guy on the street will, because everything about a guy flying in an airplane fits that category of mobile technology. They buy; they're much more highly mobile technology centric. Well, golly, I mean, like I say, within days of the iPad coming out, they were littering the airplane. That by the way, I was flying over to talk about Pico projectors when that happened. Uh-huh. And that's why I call it the airplane test, because I say, you know what?
Or AirPods.
We've had these things. By the way, same thing. We've had television glasses. And I wrote this on my blog when the Apple Vision broke. We had television goggles since the mid-90s. Mm-hmm. Sony has Glasstron. So there have been several companies have come out with TV glasses that were up to the state-of-the-art of television at the time they came out. You know, we've had TV glasses for a long time. Never took it off. You've never seen one on an airplane. I know, what was the company? Avagon. They did some deal with some airline, I think in first class or something, they tried to do it. You've not seen anybody do the technology to do movies in your eyes. If that's all you're buying Apple Vision Pro for, you can get that for a lot less money. That's been around for a long time. It hasn't taken off in a big way. And I've yet in the wild, and I've been doing this business since, like I say, in 98, Glasstron had been out for a few years. Because we had a glass, the reason I remember that is one of the first things I looked at when I was there was a Glasstron. We were, you know, saying how we're going to compete and deal with that and be a kind of an adjunct to that. We were much higher resolution because it was television. We were going for PC resolution. So we were definitely jumping up. But the technology has been around for 30 years or so, 30 plus years to be able to do TV on an airplane. People would rather look at a tiny screen or the people who didn't like looking on their phone, they bought an iPad. That turns out they'd rather do that. They'd rather look at an iPad than wear glasses. So I don't see that as a big killer app. I think so that's going to be a problem for Apple. I think we're going to see Meta. My guess is Meta is going to, like I say, see if the inklings that they're getting off of the Ray-Ban glasses. So I think that's where you're going to see the next move happen. And then whether Apple follows, I don't know. I don't have real good belief that lowering the price. I think if the Apple Vision Pro sold for $1,000, they would have sold a lot more of them, but it would probably dry up. It would just dry up at a higher number. In other words, what happened with Apple Vision Pro, everybody who needed, you know, every company in the world had to have two or three of them. Plus, you know, all the really high end techno geeks had to have a few of them. But once that was satiated, you'd hit your market. I think even if you drop it 1,000, yes, there'll be a lot more looky-loos, a lot more tries, but will it just become so much with it? You know, they talked about this a lot with the Quest 2. Quest 2 quickly became closetware. You know, they call it closetware, right? Because it like at about 200, it got down to like $200. So everyone said, for $200, I'll give it a try. And then, but then when they came out with the 3, there were a lot of those people who said, we have one of those in the closet. So if it's hard, it starts to get harder to keep selling them. So like I say, I think the trend I see, or the thing I think the next kind of shoe to drop is going to be these smart glasses. I think they're going to need to have, and it's going to be tough, as I said, how do you put cameras in there? But I think to really show stuff. And then the question is, how many people is that who will want all of that stuff?
Exactly. So, Carl, as for our last question, what are the trends you are most excited about in the display, in AR and VR display?
Well, the trends. Well, I mean, you know, micro LED is. I mean, there are arguments back and forth, even on micro LED versus LCD. Hypervision. Hypervision made an interesting point. One thing that you can kind of see from my studies, what I've looked at, is that it's really hard to make optics that are really small. When you're trying to make a big field of view, you know, while micro LEDs might feel like a trend, it's hard to say, because the micro LEDs that we're seeing in the Apple type of product are micro displays. They're on silicon chips, and that's limited. That size right now is like 1.3, 1.4 inches. And to go beyond that means you have to move the entire semiconductor industry, which ain't happening anytime soon. Yeah. So you're stuck at about, that's like the speed of light in making silicon right now. Yes, someday they'll maybe make a bigger chip, but right now those are some of the biggest chips made. They're basically right at the limit of what they can make a chip. And you can do things called stitching, but that's a whole different process. That's my problem from knowing a lot about semiconductors. But we were doing stitching back, you know, 30 years ago, and it's never taken off in a big way. But anyway, that's kind of what they're limited to. So then you get back to LCDs. So could LCDs, you know, I could see a lot happening in LCDs, maybe with mini LED or micro LED. Mini LED illumination of LCDs and stuff like that. So I think there's a chance that you're going to see LCDs remain dominant in that market, particularly if you want to go for wide field of view. You want a really big field of view, and Hypervision has some good articles on it, that they make a case that, and they're agnostic. They actually can design, they're a design house, so they can design for either one. And they say in their design analysis, you're better off to stay with an LCD. People make a big thing. By the way, people are too many single factor decision making, because LCDs, if you have to make your optics be a lot harder, a lot more difficult because you got a really small display, you lose back contrast. You know, people talk about the contrast. They always talk about the theoretical contrast. Yeah, when an OLED goes black, it goes black, but as soon as you start throwing light in there, if you have to do harder optics, you tend to get more reflections, more other problems. So it's not a clear win when you put up a realistic image, whether the contrast is going to be that much better than you would get off an LCD, a small LCD. So there's something there. In the case of AR, it's a little more interesting. I think if you're talking color, you know, right now today, LCOS is king. If you want to do a very lightweight, see-through, waveguide-based display, LCOS is king. We'll see. TI is making an interesting case. We'll see if it gets proven out. Problem with TI has always been, I've 20 years at TI, but they've always had this little reputation of being a little pricey and a little hard to work with. So we'll have to see. But technologically, their new developments at least look somewhat interesting. And then micro LED, I think the micro LED theoretically is going to be the winner. But it's still got a lot of problems, particularly you get to color. I mean, it's not as efficient as you might think, because really the where it wins, and this is, you know, if you think about it, and there's another important point on use case, the use cases that really most, if you think about it, your goal is not to be a computer. You're not watching, if you're doing AR, optical AR, you're not there to watch movies, because your black level is whatever you see. Mm-hmm. And you're not there to put up, you know, wonderful color pictures and stuff. You're really, red is good, green is good, red is bad. You know, yellow might mean caution. That's what colors are for. And you've got to be mostly transparent, both if you fill the display up with stuff, if I put stuff in front of your eyes, then you're blind. Well, yeah. You're not really augmenting. So much of augmented reality is probably low spatial content, they talk about average pixel value. So if you look at what the mm-hmm. average pixel value, probably on an AR display, it's probably 5 or 10%. That plays in favor of a display technology like micro-LEDs. By the way, OLEDs don't apply to this, other than if you do the birdbath, and the birdbath has its other issues. But if you're really talking about glasses, form factor, looking like glasses stuff, we need a really bright light source, because whatever's going to combine that in there needs really bright light. Now, it's not as inefficient as you might think. Although, if you had to fill a white screen up, it turns out DLP or LCOS is more efficient than micro-LEDs. Mm-hmm. Where micro-LEDs win is that if you only do 5%, the other guys, to get the same brightness, tend to fill up the whole display. Now, there are some tricks that people are working on to reduce that factor. But right now, micro-LEDs feel like they're the technology, but it's a long way from doing, say, a monolithic, a single, you know, instead of having to have all these optics and alignment and whatnot, to get that technology to full color is probably, at, you know, at six, even 640 by 40 might be 5 or 10 years away at best. And so the other technologies are more economical, they're more efficient in some ways. But it feels like, you know, we're going to see that play out. But like I say, right now, the interesting thing we're going to see is we're going to see a lot of LCOS and a lot of micro-LED going for this 20 to 30 degree field of view stuff. That's where everybody's lined up at the starting line to try to do that. And what we're going to see is a race of a bunch of people trying different things. And we'll see if that plays out to be anything. But, you know, among the big characters, is we know Meta is going to be there. It's not 100% clear to me whether Apple's going to be there. Is Apple rethinking their whole game plan? You know, will they lick their wounds and, you know, which way does their ego go? Do they sit there and say, well, we can't be a failure, so we're going to pour more money into it? Or do they say, maybe this wasn't the, you know, this hasn't panned out as well? Well, and will our future, you know, the future projections that we're seeing, we have to scale those back by as much as we had to scale back how many we thought we'd sell of the Apple Vision Pro. We'll see. But like I said, I don't think their problem was cost. I think I go back to functionality is king. If it's useful, like, you know, people use, you know, going back to the phone, I always say, drop my phone, but, you know, you look at a phone and you say, look, this thing, look how big this works. Is. You know, Apple could not make a phone this big until Steve Jobs died. Mm-hmm. Steve Jobs believed the phone had to be, he wanted it to work with one hand. He didn't want this too big thing. And people said it had to fit in your shirt pocket. Well, mm-hmm. guess what? People found out that they liked this so much that they'd accept a bigger one. You know,
exactly.
But, you know, they tried to do the smaller phones again, and they didn't really sell very well. I mean, there are people mm-hmm. who really like them, but that wasn't a very big market because Apple, you know, figured out that their people wanted the bigger phones. And that's why, you know, even the smaller, even the normal phone now is bigger than is as big as a Max phone.
Exactly.
And people figured out that, you know what? But this is kind of the limit short of folding, and folding's got all kinds of drawbacks. I'm not a, you know, I've never seen a folding display. It didn't have a seam in the middle. And it gets to be, it gets thicker and heavier and more unwieldy and whatnot. So this thing seems to be settled in and on a sweet spot. But this is a size, you know, frankly, it's more convenient. When I travel now, I had an iPad dedicated just for watching movies on airplanes because mm-hmm. it's a pretty feeble iPad just, you know, because airlines were doing movies. I started to just take my phone with me. You know, you get a big enough phone,
Exactly.
It works well enough. So.
Exactly.
Sorry, I accidentally hit a button on my keyboard and froze.
No, nothing happened. So that's great. So, Carl, where can our listeners find more about you and your content?
Well, I'm occasionally speak at conferences, although that's, you can look on YouTube. You can look me up on YouTube. Uh-huh. My blog is, and this was a mistake. Boy, act in haste, repent in leisure. But the name of the blog is KG on Tech, Carl Gutag on Technology. But mm-hmm. the website is kgutag, kgutag.com. Uh-huh. And basically, if you look up anything about AR particularly, but on Apple or anybody on AR, it comes up pretty high in any Google search. So I'm pretty easy to find these days. For people who have real specific interest in me, they can find me on LinkedIn. Mm-hmm. It's probably the best way to make an initial contact. I can get some kind of level of judge and some filtering through that. Because I don't want to put my email out there, but you can get to me through the blog. You can ask me questions on my blog, and then you can get at me through LinkedIn.
Awesome. We will surely put links on the description of the podcast. Well, Carl, it was great having you on the All Things Excel podcast.
Enjoyed it.
Thanks very much.
All right. Thanks a bunch. Bye-bye.
Thanks very much.